Now I want to move on to what is more the core of this retreat, which is the suttas themselves. And I would like you to have the chance to ask questions as we go along with the suttas while it's on your mind. So please, if you want to ask anything while I go through this, please just either raise your hand, or if I don't see you, raise your voice if you like as well. That's fine. And if you have any questions you don't want to ask in public, then please put those questions in the box provided outside. And as I said before, the purpose of these teachings is twofold. First of all, it's to understand what this Dhamma, the Buddha's teachings, is truly about, and to get a deeper perspective on these teachings. That's the first point of this. And I think this is, of course, very, very important in life to really to know, because when you know, then you have a choice. You can decide more clearly, you know, the extent to which you want to practice these teachings. If you don't understand what's going on with the Buddha's teachings, you can't really make any proper decisions, because you don't know what's happening, what's going on, why you should practice these things, what this is all about. So only when you have the clear picture can you make proper decisions. Do you have the right motivation for this kind of practice? And secondly, as I said before, is the inspiration in this suttas. And this inspiration can be manifold. Many types of inspirations can arise. Sometimes it's very simple. You just hear a beautiful sutta and you feel, wow, that is wonderful. And you feel inspired. And you sit down and you feel a sense of goosebumps or whatever because of such a beautiful teaching. Or it can be more kind of insight-based. You read something and you feel that you suddenly understand something to a new level. You understand something about impermanence or about death or about suffering that you have not understood before. And what happens in those situations is that you tend to let go. And that is what insight is all about. When you understand something profoundly, you let go of things. You don't hold them on anymore because you see that something is impermanent or suffering. That seeing in itself is enough for the mind to let go of these things. And that, of course, is very useful when it comes to meditation, because if you let go of things, it means that you become much more peaceful when you sit down to meditate. You're not holding on anymore. You don't have the same desires, don't have the same attachments. And then when you sit down, bang, it really works for you for the first time. And that is very important. And that is a very important part of studying the suttas, is that sort of insight that hopefully you get on the way while we do this. So this evening, I'm just going to go through some introductory suttas. And these are essentially about why it is important to study these things. And then tomorrow morning, I will come back and do more of the actual material in the suttas themselves. So this is more about the how and the why. And then tomorrow, we will move on to the First Noble Truth. And then later on tomorrow and on Sunday, I'm going to move on to the Fourth Noble Truth. And the reason for that is simply that the First Noble Truth is about understanding the problem. What is it the problem that the Buddha said that we are facing? That's what the First Noble Truth is all about. And it's only really when you understand the problem that you get the motivation, inspiration for practice. And that practice, of course, is the Fourth Noble Truth. And that's why I put these two together, because for me they sort of combine the two most important aspects of, if you like, the Buddha's teachings. When you start reading the suttas, you start to realize that the vast majority of the suttas are about the path of practice, what we need to do to overcome the problem that the Buddha lays out. So today is a couple of introductory suttas, and I will read the first one out, and then I will explain in detail what this is all about afterwards. So this sutta is called Future Perils. Bhikkhus, there are these five future perils, as yet unarisen, that will arise in the future. You should recognize them and make an effort to abandon them. What five? And I have cut out four of them, so this is only the fourth one which is left in here. Again, bhikkhus, in the future, there will be bhikkhus who are undeveloped in body, undeveloped in virtuous behavior, undeveloped in mind, and undeveloped in wisdom. When those discourses spoken by the Tathagata are being recited, that are deep, deep in meaning, world transcending, connected with emptiness, they will not want to listen to them, lend an ear to them, or apply their minds to understand them. They will not think those teachings should be studied and learnt. But when those discourses are being recited, that are mere poetry composed by poets, beautiful in words and phrases, created by outsiders, spoken by disciples, they will want to listen to them, lend an ear to them, apply their minds to understand them, and they will think those teachings should be studied and learnt. Thus, because through defilement of the Dhamma comes defilement of the training, and from defilement of the training comes defilement of the Dhamma. This is the fourth peril, as yet unarisen, that will arise in the future, and you should recognize it and make an effort to abandon it. And I'm sure you can see straight away here why I have chosen this particular discourse, because what the Buddha is saying here is that the essential thing, if we want to understand the Dhamma, is to understand the actual word of the Buddha. And that should be the backbone for our Buddhist practice. That should be the base upon which everything else rests. What he is saying here does not mean that we should never listen to discourses by other teachers. It doesn't mean that we should neglect listening to people like Ajahn Brahm or whatever other teacher that you enjoy listening to. And there are many reasons for that. One is simply that the suttas can sometimes be difficult to understand. And it can be very useful to have a teacher to explain what's going on. Until you yourself gain a sense of independence in this particular suttas. But in the meantime, it's very useful to have a teacher who can guide you in these things. So it doesn't mean that we should throw out all teachers. But what it means is that the foundation, when we ever have any question as to which teaching is wrong, which teaching is right, when we have any questions about whether a certain meditation technique actually works or doesn't work, when we have a question about the profundity of the Dhamma, what all these things actually refer to, what they point to, in the end, it is the suttas that are the final arbiter of what is true and what is right and what works. Because this is, after all, the word of the Buddha. I'm not going to go into the historical research which shows that, but I personally have no doubt that what we read in the suttas is essentially what the Buddha himself taught 2,500 years ago. It's powerful stuff. Here is the Buddha talking to you directly through 2,500 years. That is it's quite a remarkable thought when you think about it. So this is, in essence, what this is about, is that we should base ourselves on the Buddha's teachings. That should be the final guideline for what we should do. Now, I'm going to go through this in a little bit more detail. And it starts off here, it says that in the future, there will be a peril because bhikkhus who are undeveloped in body, undeveloped in virtuous behavior, undeveloped in mind, and undeveloped in wisdom. So you can see here, the peril arises because people are not practicing properly. That's why they arise. Because these four things that I mentioned here, they are the four of the factors of the Buddhist Eightfold Path. Or exactly, that's actually putting it a bit wrongly. These are four, a fourfold division of the Eightfold Path. This is just another way of dividing it into these four categories. And it is because of lack of development of the path that this happens. This is the first thing to be aware of here. So the practice of Buddhism is essential for Buddhism to stay alive. If nobody is practicing it, and all you have is the books, and you have, even if it's the suttas, it is not enough. It is a practice which is essential in a sense. And it's one of those things that I always found so inspiring in Buddhism, that on the one hand, you have this ancient teaching that goes back 2,500 years, which gives inspiration, which has been around for so long and proved itself to be so powerful and useful. And at the same time, we also have a tradition which is alive, which still you can find teachers and people who radiate some of those qualities that the Buddha spoke about in those very discourses. It's that combination which is so powerful. And it's that combination which the Buddha, in a sense, is talking about here. He's saying, it's only when people do not practice Buddhism that they stop listening to the suttas, is essentially what he's saying here. If you do practice, if you do penetrate the teachings, you will also understand the power of the word of the Buddha, and you will tend to take an interest in it. So what does it mean, undeveloped in body, undeveloped in virtuous behavior, undeveloped in mind, undeveloped in wisdom? Now the strangest term here is undeveloped in body, because of course this has got nothing to do with your physical well-being, whether you have exercised well or not. It's got nothing to do with that whatsoever. Development in body is really a term that was used before the time of the Buddha, was part of the Indian scene before that time, and it refers to the ascetic practices of the Hindus that they used before, you know, they have always used, they still use today in India today, you still find people doing ascetic practices. And it's always been that way. That's actually probably a bit of an exaggeration, but it's been that way for a very long time. So that is what they meant by development of the body, was the practicing of austere practices in those days. Now, the Buddha, of course, says that this is a wrong practice, this practice austerity to such an extent. So for the Buddha, the meaning here, and this becomes clear in such suttas as the Mahasatrika Sutta and the Majjhima Nikaya, which you may know about, which is a sutta about the Buddha's life story. It's a very beautiful sutta, by the way. But there it is quite clear that the meaning here is sense restraint. So undeveloped in body means that they haven't been practicing sense restraint. One of the foundations of the path is this sense restraint, particularly in monastic life. And of course, sense restraint, the senses have to do with the body. For that reason, because the body and the senses in many ways are almost interchangeable, that is why undeveloped in body means that you haven't put those senses under control, that you tend to find a lot of delight and happiness through those five senses, rather than realizing that that is a danger for your samadhi if you do that. So that is the meaning here of the undeveloped in body, not having practiced sense restraint. And you will notice that only after undeveloped in body comes undeveloped in virtuous behavior. You can see that there is a sequence here from lower to higher. It ends up with undeveloped in wisdom. So it's interesting that undeveloped in virtue comes after undeveloped in sense restraint. You might have thought it was the other way around. But the point, of course, is that virtue in Buddhism is a very profound thing. It's not just about how you speak and how you act, but virtue in Buddhism is also about your mental state, how you think as well. And for that reason, that is why it comes after sense restraint, because only after you restrain your senses, after you stop yourself from desiring things and being averse to things in the sensory world, that's what sense restraint is all about, not getting too attracted and too repelled by things in the world. Only then have you got the chance to make your mind relatively peaceful and overcoming the five, in particular the five hindrances, in particular the first two of those five hindrances. And this is a very important aspect of the Buddhist path, which people often forget, that virtue is also the virtue of the mind. So for that reason, it is very important to practice things like loving-kindness meditation, because that is one of the wonderful ways of helping yourself to purify your mind. And it is only really through that sort of practice that in the long run you will be able to purify your virtue to the extent that they're talking about here. So that is why virtuous behavior here is so high and why it comes after sense restraint. So please keep in mind that virtuous behavior includes the virtue of the mind, the non-desire and non-ill will in particular of the mind. And if you find that your meditation isn't going so well, then maybe this is one of the areas you should look at. instead of just trying to plug away at the breath all the time, try some of these other things which purify you, such as loving kindness or compassion, and practice in that area instead. And maybe you will find that suddenly even your breath meditation starts to improve dramatically because of that. And that is why the next factor here is undeveloped in mind. Now, undeveloped in mind means undeveloped in samadhi. The word mind in the suttas is often a synonym. This is the word citta in the suttas. Is often used synonymously with samadhi. So you can see the word citta sometimes used in a strange way and you wonder what it means. That is often samadhi. That's what it means here. So that samadhi only happens once the virtue has been established properly. And then, of course, from that samadhi comes the wisdom. And this means the real wisdom, the breakthrough of the four paths and fruits. And this is what is meant by wisdom here. So in a sense, this, what you see here, is a summary of the whole Buddhist path, from sense restraint all the way up to the wisdom, the Arya, the noble wisdom of the noble ones, is what you see here. And the point the sutta is making is only when you practice these things that the Dhamma will be preserved for posterity, for future generations. Now, you may perhaps wonder, do all of these four have to be practiced? What if I practice only two of these? Will it then be preserved or will it not be preserved? What if I practice three or one? And I think the answer here is that there is a gradualness here. And this is a way of understanding these sort of suttas, which I often use and I think is important. When you have four factors like this, it means that if you practice none of them, you are certainly not preserving the path, preserving the word of the Buddha. If you practice all four, you are definitely preserving the word of the Buddha. If you're practicing some of them, not the others, then you are partially preserving the word of the Buddha. This is how this series should be understood, I believe. There's lots of these kind of series found in the suttas elsewhere. So, then the Buddha goes on and says that, well, when these things are not being practiced, what happens then? Well, then what happens is that when those discourses spoken by the Tathagata, the Buddha, in other words, are being recited, that are deep, deep in meaning, world-transcending, connected with emptiness, they will not want to listen to them, lend an ear to them, or apply their minds to understand them. They will not think that those teachings should be studied and learned. So these teachings by the Buddha are here qualified and called deep and deep in meaning. I think that is fairly obvious what that means. They are profound, they're not easy to understand. They can only be understood through deep meditation, through deep practice. This is what is meant here. They are world transcending. In other words, they lead you out of this world, out of this samsara, the suffering of the world. They go beyond this world, completely outside of it. And they are connected with emptiness. And this is perhaps the most profound of these aspects here, which concerns the Buddha's teachings, that they are connected with emptiness. Emptiness, this word has many different meanings, depending on which Buddhist tradition you belong to. But in the Theravada tradition, in the Pali words of the Buddha, emptiness just means that things are empty of a self and empty of those things that belong to a self. That's all it really means. So when it says here that the suttas are connected with emptiness, it means that they are connected with this idea of non-self and there being nothing that belongs to a self. That's what it means. It doesn't have any kind of wider philosophical implications that you may find in some of the later scriptures and also in the Mahayana teachings. In the early suttas, this is all that it means. So, and this is also, I think, one of the important things to understand, that connected with emptiness, with non-self, that this is one of those things that distinguishes the Buddha's teachings from pretty much every other teaching in the world. This is the one thing which is like the characteristic of the Buddha's teachings par, par excellence, the most outstanding thing here, which makes it different from almost everything else. And that is, of course, why the Buddha mentions it at this particular point. Because this is the profound and the kind of that is why the teaching is world transcending. Yeah? Because it understands the emptiness of all phenomena, understands the emptiness of everything in the world, that nothing is worth holding on to. And this is what makes the Buddha's teaching so special. And that's why he mentions this at this particular point. All other teachings that are not spoken by either a Buddha or somebody who has learned the teachings from a Buddha or somebody who is enlightened perhaps in some other way will not have that understanding of non-self. That this is a distinguishing mark of the Buddha's teachings, if there is one here. So, those teachings, those profound teachings, those that are really the special teachings of the Buddha and his disciples, they will not listen to these teachings, lend an ear to them, or apply their minds to understand them. And the reason they don't do that is because they haven't developed themselves, so they don't understand that these things are important to understand. And they will not think those teachings should be studied and learned. This is one reason why I like, personally, to have a retreat like this, where we can go into these kind of teachings, to actually study them a bit more, and sort of avoid the trap that the Buddha is talking about right here. But when those discourses are being recited, that are mere poetry, composed by poets, beautiful in words and phrases, created by outsiders, spoken by disciples, then they will want to listen to them, lend an ear to them, apply their minds to understand them, and they will think those teachings should be studied and learned. So here, these teachings are the teachings of poetry composed by poets. And of course, the idea of poetry is that poetry is always something beautiful. There's a sense of something which is done not just to transmit a teaching, to transmit something profound, but poetry also has a sense of beauty about it. It's something which is composed in a certain way, according to a certain meter, according to a certain rhythm, according perhaps to rhymes and all these kind of things. And often that beauty aspect of poetry becomes more important than the content. So this is one of the things the Buddha is saying here. Well, we shouldn't focus so much on the beauty of things. It is the content that really matters. Of course, the Buddha also sometimes spoke in poetry, in verse. And there is, I think, a place for that also in the Buddha's teachings. Because it can be inspiring, it can lift you up when something is beautiful. But remember that the most profound teachings of the Buddha are likely to be found in the prose rather than in the verse. Simply because prose is meant to be direct, is meant to speak directly to you without any kind of embellishment of beauty and meter and rhythm and all these other kind of things. And then he says they are beautiful in words and phrases, of course, because this is poetry created by outsiders. Now, outsiders in Buddhism means all those people who are not Buddhists. So it refers to all kind of other religions. It refers to people who are perhaps not religious at all. And I think this is an important thing to take into account. Because sometimes in Buddhism, Buddhists will say, oh yeah, all teachings lead in the same way. All teachings are ultimately the same. They lead to the same goal. It doesn't matter so much what you are. Perhaps the Buddha's teachings are a little bit better because they are very clear and very precise, but essentially teachings are the same. But what the Buddha is saying here is that they're not the same. He's saying if they are created by outsiders who are not Buddhist, they are not going to be those profound teachings connected with emptiness that you found in the Buddha's own teachings. So keep that in mind. It is not the same whether you are a Muslim or you are a Christian or a Jew or a Hindu or a Shintoist or whatever, or a Nordic, where you worship the Nordic gods or whatever. It is not the same. These things are different. And if you think about it, it makes sense that they are different. I mean, the world is full of different ideas. The world is full of different ways of looking at things. And many of these things are incompatible with each other. Why should all religions be the same? Why should they all lead in the same way? It doesn't really, to me, it doesn't make any sense to think like that. I think the reason why people do want to think like that, because it is a kind of feel-good thing. They think, oh yeah, we're all together in the same boat. We're all really practicing the same thing. And it kind of feels good. It means that we don't have to sort of argue with each other so much. But the point, of course, is that to be tolerant of others, it does not mean that we necessarily agree with them. Tolerance means that we accept somebody else even though they have a different view from us. We don't denounce them because they have a different view. We don't put them down. We accept, okay, you have your view. You are entitled to have your own view. I'm not going to persecute you or give you a hard time because of that view. You are entitled to that. But I happen to disagree. I am going in this direction. You're going that direction. And that's okay. It's important to be able to have that distinction in the world, to allow us to have different views about these matters. And this is what the Buddha is saying here, is that outsiders, those things created by outsiders, are not going to be as profound as those suttas spoken by the Buddha. What that means, again, it means that, you know, we don't have to necessarily always, we can also read other things apart from the Buddhist things, but at the end, it is the Buddhist suttas that are going to be our ultimate guideline. And then comes the next factor here, which I find is very interesting and which I often have reflected on as very important, and that is spoken by disciples. In other words, those discourses that are being spoken by disciples, people will listen to those rather than listening to the discourses spoken by the Buddha. And when I have looked around personally around the Buddhist world over the past 15 years I've been a monk, I always found that people tend to listen to talks by this teacher, by that teacher. They practice this kind of meditation technique and that type of meditation technique. Whatever they are called, they have all these names and have all these different teachers teaching these things. But very few people, it may be happening a bit more now in recent years, but generally speaking, very few people go to the word of the Buddha. They always go to these other teachers to understand what Buddhism is all about. And, of course, what the Buddha is saying here is that, well, that is not the best thing to do, because sometimes you just don't know who these teachers are. They may sound very articulate, very eloquent. They may have all these, they may be very charismatic. They may have all these qualities which are absolutely astounding. And we get very attracted to their magnetic personalities and all these kind of things. And yet, they may not really have understood the Dhamma. And this is a danger. And this is the thing. You may actually be short-changed in your search for the real teachings sometimes, unless you place your foundation understanding in the suttas themselves. So be careful with that. Again, I'm not saying that you should never listen to anybody else apart from the Buddha. You have to do that as well. It's important that we do that as well, because sometimes you need the gaps to be filled in. You need additional understanding. You need the presence of somebody who is maybe like a living teacher of the tradition. That is very, very powerful to see that. But always go back to the suttas to check for authenticity, check for the real teachings, what they actually are. That is what the Buddha is saying here. And you can ask, like somebody did the other day, well, what about when I read the suttas and suddenly you find a sutta spoken not by the Buddha, but by one of the disciples? Does that also fall under this category? And I would say, ultimately, yes, it does. When you read the suttas, even those suttas that are spoken by the famous disciples like Venerable Ananda, Venerable Mahamoggallana, and perhaps even Venerable Sariputta, should be second to those suttas spoken by the Buddha. Even that far I would go. Possibly with a partial exception of Venerable Sariputta, because the Buddha praised him so highly and said that, well, if anybody is going to keep rolling the wheel of the Dhamma, it is not me, it's going to be Venerable Sariputta. It's almost like the Buddha placed him almost on an equal standing with himself. So his word are perhaps the ones that are most authentic apart from the word of the Buddha. But that is how far I would take this particular teaching here. So, and then, of course, what he's saying here is that these, only when these people, these poets, these outsiders, these disciples, when they speak, then people will listen. Then they will apply their minds to understand. And it's those teachings that should be studied and learned, they think. And I have found in my own life that this is often what happens in too many places, in my opinion. And people are not careful enough to check with actually what the Buddha himself taught. Thus, because through defilement of the Dhamma comes defilement of the discipline or the training I have changed it to. And from defilement of the training comes defilement of the Dhamma. So the defilement of the Dhamma here is the fact that these monks, the bhikkhus are mentioned here. Of course, it also means bhikkhunis, it means lay people, but of course the Sangha is usually supposed to be the highest, the most reliable repository of these teachings. So for that reason, I think bhikkhus and bhikkhunis are the most important parts here. So the defilement of the Dhamma means that they haven't realized these teachings. Not realizing it is like a defilement of the Dhamma, because it's not clear in your mind. When the teachings aren't clear, then the training isn't clear. So, because you don't understand what's going on, you don't train properly. And the training here, in this particular context, is that you don't listen properly to the right suttas. You listen in the wrong place. Understanding things, listening to things, examining them, is part of that Buddhist training. So because it's part of the training, in this context, that's what it actually means. And because you don't train properly, in other words, from the defilement of the training comes the defilement of the Dhamma. Because you don't train properly, you don't penetrate that Dhamma. You don't understand what the Buddha actually talked about. So it becomes like a vicious circle. You don't understand the Dhamma properly, you don't train properly. Because you don't train properly, you cannot understand the Dhamma. And the whole thing becomes very problematic. And you can see how this leads to the decline of Buddhism very fast in this particular way here. So, for that reason, the Buddha says, this is the fourth future peril, as yet unarisen, that will arise in the future. You should recognize it and make an effort to abandon it. So, and does anybody have any questions about this sutta? Does it make everybody perfect sense to everybody? Yeah. Okay, good. Yeah, it's actually, I think it's reasonably straightforward probably. Yeah. So, I'll just move on to the next sutta. So, that is, the first one then is about the importance of understanding, of studying the discourses of the Buddha. And the next one is a following up on this particular one here. This is called the decline of the good Dhamma. The good Dhamma, the Saddhamma in Pali, is the Dhamma of the Buddha, of course, and the Dhamma which is in accordance with reality, the way things actually are. Bhikkhus, I should say, the Buddha always says, bhikkhus, it doesn't mean that these teachings aren't for other people as well. The reason is simply that most of the teachings given by the Buddha was given to the monks. And for that reason, they always start off with bhikkhus. But of course, it's equally relevant for bhikkhunis and for laymen and laywomen who are Buddhists. These are for everybody, basically, these teachings. And sometimes we find in the sutta that the lay people will teach the bhikkhus the Dhamma. So it is not unheard of that it is the situation is completely reversed from what it normally is. So, the decline of the good Dhamma. Bhikkhus, there are these five things that lead to the decline and disappearance of the good Dhamma. What five? Here, the bhikkhus do not learn the Dhamma, the discourses, the mixed prose and verse, expositions, verses, inspired utterances, quotations, birth stories, marvelous accounts, and questions and answers. This is the first thing that leads to the decline and disappearance of the good Dhamma. Again, the bhikkhus do not teach the Dhamma to others in detail, as they have heard it and learnt it. This is the second thing that leads to the decline and disappearance of the good Dhamma. Then I move on to the last one. Again, the bhikkhus do not ponder, examine, and mentally inspect the Dhamma as they have heard it and learnt it. This is the fifth thing that leads to the decline and disappearance of the good Dhamma. These are the five things that lead to the decline and disappearance of the good Dhamma. So, you can see here that what the Buddha is saying here is that it is the discourses by the Buddha. And the first factor here, he talks about learning the Dhamma. Now, all the things that I mentioned here, discourses, mixed prose and verse and all these things, these are the teachings of the Buddha himself. And what he's saying here, and this fits exactly with what we heard just before, is that if you don't learn the teachings of the Buddha, then that leads to the decline of Buddhism. So if all we do is listening to other teachers, whoever they may be, and I'm saying this very, very broadly, whoever they may be, including, of course, Ajahn Brahm or anybody else, if that's all we do, then we are, in a sense, helping or pushing forward this decline and disappearance of the good Dhamma. We become part of the problem, so to speak, if we don't learn the teachings of the Buddha himself. That is, I think, is a very important thing to reflect on, because it shows us, you know, that actually it is the understanding of these teachings which prolongs the sasana and the Buddha's teachings. So the first thing here, then, is that they do not learn, and then this whole series here of things, and some of you may wonder what this is all about, because it talks about discourses, mixed prose and verse, expositions, verses, inspired utterances, etc., etc. Now this list here is a standard list in the suttas, which is supposed to be like all-encompassing, and to encompass all the different types of text that you find in the suttas. And if you read the commentary will explain to you that inspired utterances, the Pali here is the Udana. Now that means the Udana, which is one of the books of the Tipitaka. Quotations is the Itivuttaka, which is another book of the Tipitaka. Birth stories is the Jataka, which the commentary says is the Jatakas find also in the Tipitaka. Marvelous accounts. This is the Acharya Abhuta Dhamma, which is, again, a few of the discourses found in the suttas. So this is how the commentary explains these things. It probably doesn't mean that, because these ways of classifying the suttas came out long before the commentaries were ever composed. So what these mean probably are just more different types of suttas that are found in the suttas, mixed in everywhere. So birth stories probably just means those suttas where the Buddha talks about his own past life, and not actually the Jatakas, which is a later kind of genre of Pali literature. So essentially, what we come down to then is that these different categories here basically mean the word of the Buddha. You will find that in other schools of Buddhism, they have 12 categories. This is only 9 here. They have 12 categories. And it sort of shows us that what has happened here is that this sequence of different types of texts is something that has been expanded over time. There are certain suttas which only talk about 3 different kind of categories. And those categories are the discourses. The first one here, suttas, mixed prose and verse, and the expositions. That's all they talk about. And it is possible that this is like the original kernel through which the rest of these categories came to be. And discourses are the suttas, mixed prose and verse are the kind of suttas that you sometimes see, and the Buddha finishes off with a verse on the end, like an inspired verse. And the expositions, the Vyakarana, they are like the explanations of the suttas. And the rest can sort of be subsumed under those headings. The first 3 here are probably the most important ones. But regardless, it just means the teachings of the Buddha. So these are the things we should learn, the teachings of the Buddha. And then the second thing we should do is to teach this to other people in detail. This is the second factory. And if we don't do that, then again, we are neglecting the suttas and we are become a contributing factor to the decline and disappearance of the good Dhamma. And this is one reason why I again like to focus on the suttas, because I feel that if I do that, perhaps I can be a tiny little contribution to upholding the Buddha's teachings in the future. Of course, you will also recognize here that one of the reasons why the emphasis here is on learning the Dhamma is because in the time of the Buddha, this actually meant memorizing these teachings. Of course, today you don't have to memorize them in the same way. So today it's more about reading it in the books and understanding it. But the last category which comes now is just as relevant today as it was in the time of the Buddha. This last category is that the bhikkhus do not ponder, examine and mentally inspect the Dhamma as they have heard it and learnt it. This is the fifth thing that leads to the decline and disappearance of the good Dhamma. And this is one of the wonderful things that you have an opportunity on a retreat like this. You can actually think about these teachings. You can come and listen to what I have to say, and then you can go back and think about it, and then you can maybe have some more questions about it, or you can maybe even disagree with some of the things that I have to say, which is perfectly fine. And then you can develop that understanding of these teachings. It is important to ponder, examine, and mentally inspect it. There is a sutta somewhere in the Anguttara Nikaya, where the Buddha talks about three different types of wisdom. And he talks about the person who goes to listen to a talk by the Buddha or by some famous disciple. And as soon as they have listened to that talk, they go away and they never even think about it afterwards. They don't even pay proper attention while they're there. Then there's the disciple who sits there and listens properly to the teachings. But as soon as they depart, they never think about those teachings again. And then there is the real disciple who practices in the right way. And that is the person who listens to the teaching while they are there in the presence of the Buddha or a disciple of the Buddha. And then they also reflect on those teachings afterwards, ponder them and examine them and come to understand them. And that is, of course, the appropriate way of using these kind of these teachings. And only then, only when we do that, do we actually contribute to the non-decline and perseverance of the good Dhamma in the world. And all of this refers to the teachings of the Buddha and not any other kind of teaching. Jo. Well, I think, again, it's about, you know, everything in Buddhism is about balance. And some of the Dhamma can become like an intellectual exercise. Where all you do is sort of think about the Dhamma all day and you write books about it and you read lots of other books and all you do is this, you know, that's all you do. And of course, that can go too far. But I think that what you have to do is you have to feel satisfied that you understand what's going on. And once you have reached a certain level of satisfaction that you know what's going on, then you have to put those things into practice. And most people know that. They know that, okay, now I know enough. Now I know what this Dhamma is all about. Now I need to practice. You can feel that for yourself when you have sufficient information. I think the reason why people like to intellectualize very often and like to think and ponder excessively is simply because they think they cannot meditate. They think, oh, I can't meditate. I can't do this. I'll just study instead. Or sometimes it can be a response to suffering. You have suffering in life, okay. Every time I sit down and try to be peaceful, all I feel is just, you know, displeasure and I don't feel really happy and discontent and all those kind of things. So I'll study instead. That's one possibility. And there's all kind of things people do so they don't have to practice. They can, you know, it's not just studying. It can be working, can be exactly the same thing. You can keep on, you know, building this and building that for the rest of your life. Again, it can be like an escape mechanism. So you're quite right. It's important to find a balance between practice and study. But I think most people know when they have enough information, they feel like they're satisfied. And then, once you have enough information, instead of going to the suttas just to understand more, you can use the suttas for inspiration. And that is a great thing of using it. You know, you go back to your kuti, or you go back to your room or whatever it is, and you read a sutta and you feel inspired. You feel, wow, this is great. And then you sit, and then it actually boosts your meditation practice. Yes, anyway. Okay, yeah. Left out, yeah. Ooh. Very briefly, okay. I'm not sure if I can remember them, to be quite honest with you, because I haven't actually got them here with me. Now, what are they again? I should. I can tell you roughly what the two ones that are left out regarding decline of the good Dhamma. And that is, most of that is just about teaching things in detail, and it's just an elaboration on the second one, really, on how far you take the teachings. So I took it out because it didn't really add very much to the present thing. Yeah. The future perils. I don't think I can bring it to mind at the moment, anyway. So what I will do, I'll bring it out tomorrow instead, and I'll let you know tomorrow when I come back out. But it's actually interesting. There's actually four suttas in that particular section of the Anguttara Nikaya, and they're all about future perils. And there's all kind of things in there about, one of them is one interesting one, which I was reading out to the monks just recently, is about living in too close proximity for monks with bhikkhunis. That's one of them. Because you create bonds, you create bonds and things and commonality with somebody of the opposite gender. And that can be one of the perils which I actually mentioned in there. And other such things as well. But I will bring that out tomorrow and then take it from there. Oh, they are. Oh, sure they are. No, they can. And that was, for me, was very interesting when I read this. There's one sutta, that the one I was actually referring to, is in the Samyutta Nikaya, and there is a layman. He is a very, very accomplished layperson. His name is Chitta. The layperson Chitta, and he was an anagami, non-returner. So he was, very, very highly accomplished. And he said that he would go to the monks and he would offer dhamma. And he would say that, well, if the venerables don't teach me the dhamma, I will teach dhamma to the venerables. And that's what he did. And it's quite nice, because it means that it's not kind of an exclusive relationship. It's about whoever has the dhamma, whoever has the knowledge, they are the teacher. And that is... That is actually what's going on there. No, sure you can. Sure, of course you can listen to that. Yeah, it's not a problem. That's fine. And it's good. It's good not to... Sorry?
Could you repeat the question so we can...
Okay, sorry, yeah. She was just asked, I was referring to something before that I was saying that there are times when, in the suttas, when the lay people are teaching the monks. And she was just asking about what I was referring to. And that's what I was answering here. Yeah. Yeah, he was just saying that it even happens now, because you have teachers like Goenka, the famous Goenka courses, and many monks and nuns would go to those courses to learn meditation practice as well. Okay, anybody else want to say anything? Everybody happy? Yeah? I think I will, it's already about 9:30, so I'll probably stop there. Then I will see you again all tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock tomorrow morning. So.